Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
If you love something, you have to work twice as hard as everyone else.
Nick Newell against Rich Reynolds for the lightweight championship belt.
You are me now. Fight.
I didn't come this far to lose.
Remember what we practiced.
Stand up for yourself.
You can do it, Nick.
How many punches am I going to have to take before I get him to the ground?
A few.
But you got a thick skull.
Ah, what drama, what cool stuff. Hi, everybody. This is Paul Listick from WGN-TV, but welcome to the podcast Behind the Curtain. That is a brief scene from a movie that's just open. You can watch it in the theaters where it plays. Or watch it streaming, and it is called Notorious Nick. It is the true story of a fighter named Nick Newell. We're going to learn all about it from one of the stars of the film. It's and he's a name you know, even though you know him from some pretty different places, but he's great in this movie, so we're going to talk to him. Joining me is actor and singer and producer, and he's everything. Barry Livingston joins us from California. Barry, thanks for joining me.
No, my pleasure, Paul. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, look, everybody knows you. They all think I'm going to be talking about My Three Sons because you, of course, played Ernie and even wrote a book about your life called The Importance of Being Ernie, although that was about 10 years ago. Time for a volume two on that one. But
I'm accumulating more stories.
Yeah, that's good. And by the way, you're a great writer. I got to tell you, although I read it years ago, I reviewed it for our interview. I like one night read through the whole thing because it's just really quick, fast reading and really interesting, and you have some
That's
stories
great.
I'm going to ask you about because we got to clear some up about some famous people. First of all,
Thank
let's
you.
Talk about
Thank
Notorious
you.
Nick. I know some people think Cody Christian is a heartthrob from Teen Wolf and other things. I think you're the heartthrob, Barry. What do you think?
Well, that's a friend of mine who's a screenwriter. He said, you know, I love the movie. And he said, I don't really like MMA stuff that much. But he said, you know, where was the love story? You know, I said, Nick and Barry and Cody were the love story. What are you talking about? That was the love story. Because I played his coach and his wrestling coach in high school. And I go on to be his MMA trainer. It was an amazing, the real life story. It's just an absolute miracle that Nick Newell, who was born with a congenital defect, missing his forearm, that's pretty hard to go anywhere in life, let alone into the world of mixed martial arts fighting and succeed. And he had a dream. He would not let up on it. He, determined to persevere, and boy, did he, because he eventually rose to the top of his field and won a world championship.
And of course, unlike so many of the characters you've played in life, which are fictional, this is real. And in fact, by the way, I would encourage people, when you watch the movie, don't leave before the credits are over, because we actually get some scenes with the real Nick Newell, with the real coach. So I have to ask you, how much of your portrayal is your doing, and how much of it did you get to meet and interview the real folks, and how were you influenced?
No, that's always a little bit risky after the fact, you know, but you've got to bring your own experience to the characters and to play. And yeah, you know, you can get something from it, but sometimes the real person, you know, their whole view of themselves and how they're being depicted can be at odds. And I don't need that. You know, I need to have a clear idea of what I want to do. I did some research and I went to a friend set me up with a wrestling coach at one of the high schools out here. And I went and hung out in his class for a few sessions. Got an idea of how he interacted with the kids because they were, teenagers, late teens. They're all high school guys. And, of course, I did go to some MMA fights. But, yes, to interact with the real-life character you're going to play, sometimes it can be tricky, and I wanted to avoid that.
So I watched the film. I loved it. So now I love talking to you because I get to ask you some questions. First of all, I'm assuming what we're seeing with regard to Nick's character, we're getting special effects in there really well done because they've got to carry that throughout the film.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the fights themselves are all choreographed and done in real time. The CGI that you're talking about, the special effects are what had to be done to remove Cody Christian's forearm. so he could be Nick, you know, so he could portray Nick in with his particular handicap that he had.
Was that sort of a green screen?
Everything else, there was no CGI in that fighting. I mean, Cody took a beating every day. And the guy's a champ. He's a total beast. Great actor. You know, I know he's got 5 million followers on Instagram, and I hope every one of them goes to see him with his shirt off, because I'm sure they'll be very impressed.
And I hope 5 million of them come to you. I don't follow him on Instagram, but I do follow you. So, as I said, you're the sex symbol. But I also have to ask you, there's some scenes you do some wrestling. You kind of, I guess, answered it now I know, but there are some wrestling moves, and I'm going, okay, do we have a stunt guy in there, Barry? Are you doing this?
No, you know, I mean, that was part of the challenge. And when I read that, I went, I don't know anything about wrestling. And boy, you know, to depict a wrestling coach, you know, usually those guys were ex-wrestlers themselves and wind up in high school later in their years and teach. So I went, I have to look believable. I have to look convincing. And, we had great people to work with that showed us how to do certain kind of moves. And that's what you had. Three or four things maybe I had to learn, unlike Cody, who had to really, get in there and box with professional boxers. The guys that were in the ring with him were real MMA guys. They were great. But again, for me, I had to display a few couple moves here and there. And that was a concern of mine, that I wanted to look like I really knew these moves in and out, no question. And I'm looking at it on screen, I'm going, okay, it's convincing. I buy it. So very happy about that.
Yeah, well, that's why I even had to ask you, did you really do those moves? Because we see them. By the way, Kevin Pollak's in this movie, Elizabeth Rome. It's a really great cast.
It is. This was a low-budget film. I can tell you it was under $1 million. I can't tell you how much under, because probably they don't want me to throw those kind of numbers out there. Sure. But, substantially. And let's just say, every penny that you see on screen is wisely used. Looks like a movie that probably cost $40 million. I don't know. You hear budgets these days of Marvel movies and whatever, $500 million, $200 million for Avatar. Not knocking it. That money goes to a lot of technical people, CGI posts. That the money doesn't just go into the producer and director's pocket. It's well spent. But yeah, this movie really, really came together in a way that I'm so proud of. It looks great. It's a good film for families, because it's got a great positive message about never giving up, following your dreams. It's got some MMA action for the guys that like that kind of world. And it's not so overwhelming that kids would be like, that's too scary. It's good enough. I mean, it's great. And I think the producer did a fantastic, and Aaron Leong, who is the director, pretty tough job to do all that in the limited amount of time and money he had. So yeah, it really works. It really, really is a good film. I'm so proud of it.
And now that I know that those are real MMA fighters, I'm not an MMA guy, so now that I know those are real MMA fighters in there, I have to ask you, did anybody get hurt in this, or do they know what they're doing very carefully and nobody got hurt?
They rehearsed, and Cody Christian, is a total pro, and I heard him talking about it the other day. He said, they had a stunt coordinator and choreographer the first time around, and it was early days, and he just, I don't know who the guy was, and it's not important, but they found somebody else that really, really knew that world. And he brought in his guys too. He says Tony Vella is the guy who did all the stunt choreography. And so he had a pool of guys that he could bring in that he knew could do the job. And we're happy as Sammy Horowitz, who plays I can't think of the character's name offhand, but he's the guy in the end that really, Rich Reynolds, I think his name is, the MMA fighter that Nick Newell eventually faces off with in the championship round. And, sweetest guy, he looks like you tear your head off, but he's the sweetest human being on earth. And he was really, really helpful to me if I had questions, or with Cody. And sure, Cody said, occasionally you wouldn't duck when you're supposed to get, duck, and you'd get clocked. And, he kept on going. And that's just the nature of these kind of movies, I think, when you do a film like Rocky or whatever, there's inherent danger. And that, you know, you mitigate it as best you can being professional, but it's there.
And you know, there's, I don't want to give too much away. I want people to see the movie, but there's a little kid involved in the film too. And there's a little scene at the end after the fight that involves a little kid. You know what I'm talking about. And I thought to myself, oh, that's so hokey. I don't really think that happened. And then of course they run the clip from the real world and it actually did happen. That was real stuff.
Yeah. No, you know, sometimes things that are actually real and can be in the context of a movie can be sometimes you go, oh, well, okay, that's convenient, you know. But nonetheless, I had the same reaction, honestly, when I saw it. I went, hmm. But then at the end, it's explained. He's a real guy. He really did meet, Nick Newell did meet this young kid. And before him, Nick Newell met Jim Abbott, who was the great pitcher, who was one-armed, and it was an inspiration for him. And so it was a kind of a pay-it-forward moment. But when you see the real kid and it really happened, you kind of forgive that moment, I think, as the movie unfolds. If you have one moment going, maybe that's jumping the shark a little bit. Yeah. But nonetheless, it's a minor blip, the movie overall. Yeah. Just sails and really flows well, and the great acting of Kevin Pollak, who is excellent. Elizabeth Rome plays Cody's mom, who clearly has a lot of concerns about her son getting his ass whipped and brain damage. You know, that's a big concern for a parent, that when your child gets into that kind of a dangerous situation. So all of that's in the film. It's a really great movie for families and everybody, young people who love Cody, the guys who dig MMA. It's all there.
Well, I see Notorious Nick as a film. It's kind of like, if you know the film Rudy, right? It becomes this cult movie over the years. It's what's one of the best, you know, feel good movies. And that's what Notorious Nick is. And so I really encourage folks to get it to theaters, but it's also available for streaming on various services.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, sadly, the times that it's being released, it is in select theaters nationwide, not everywhere. You'd have to look for it. Might not even be in your town. But nonetheless, I think it's on, you can find it on Amazon Prime or Apple TV, I think, or Vudu, maybe soon Hulu. You know, you got a $5.99 is the price. It's well worth it. I think it's a bargain, actually. And, sad.
Actually,
I think
to be honest with you, Barry. To be honest, Barry, it never occurred to me to go find it in my town. I prefer to find it in my living room. And so that's what I did on my own big screen and just enjoyed it there.
I'm old school, and I hear you. And I hear everybody kind of going, particularly with the world of COVID, the way it exists now. Yeah, people are going, hey, I'm staying home and watching it on my big screen.
Exactly.
That even when things maybe go back to normal, I worry about the future of historically what's been an institution in America of seeing a movie with a live audience of people you don't know, and you go to a theater and get your popcorn, and that may be on the way out. I hope not, because I love that experience. But thank God in these times that there are these platforms, Netflix and Amazon and all these places that, you know, you can still get your entertainment. And I think you're right. I think the film will probably find its biggest following. Hopefully now, maybe people will word of mouth will spread. But maybe over time, it'll be one of those like Rudy or something of that ilk, you know.
I think it's great. And I can't have you, Barry, without talking about, you know, you got to reminisce, right? So let me bring our listeners into the fold here by playing a little music that will be quite familiar for everybody. Sound familiar, Barry?
You know, I involuntarily have to tap my feet when I hear that song. It's like a Manchurian Candidate kind of thing. I just, you know, it's a twitch. I'm tapping. Well, still tapping. I got to stop my tap.
Yeah, that, of course, it's an iconic theme song. My Three Sons, a show you starred in, along with several others, including your real-life brother. And by the way, you may not realize this was for me, but as you know, your brother Stan is an artist, and among other things, a stained glass artist. And so I have several of his pieces. And in a conversation with him some years ago, I asked him if he ever did a stained glass piece of the logo of My Three Sons, of those tapping feet. He kind of laughed and said, no, I never have. And you know what, Barry? He did it. He did it for me. And you went over to his house one day, along with Don and Tim Constantine, and you all signed it. Do you have any memory of doing that?
No.
Okay, well, he threw a barbecue. You went for a barbecue.
I could lie and say yes, but actually, I kind of remembered that he did a stained glass window with the sun's, you know, the legs. I have no recollection beyond that.
I'm going to prove it to you.
Breakfast this morning, either.
I'm going to prove it to you. You may not know what you had for breakfast, but I can prove what he did because I've got your brother Stan joining us right now. He actually is having breakfast. I think we're interrupting his pancakes and eggs, but I wanted to call him to verify everything. Stan, I'm talking to your brother Barry.
I hear you. I've been listening to the conversation, and my eggs are done. How you doing?
Hey, there's a voice I know and love. Hey, Stan.
Hey, so yes, I know that not a huge surprise bringing two brothers on who know each other so well, but just so many things I want to reminisce about with you, and I want to try and maybe ask some things that other people don't ask you every time they talk to you. But Stan, you can confirm you made that stained glass art piece for me, and your brother signed it, right?
Yes, I did. Yeah, it was a long time ago. So we're lucky we can remember anything. And Barry said, I don't remember what I did yesterday.
We should give a plug because you do other artwork, you do lots of things. So what's the website people can go check out your artwork?
Well, it's kind of a legacy website, but it's stanleylivingstonart.com. I don't think I've done anything new to put on there in a while. It's probably about 90s, 91, 93. In fact, the very last piece of stained glass I ever did, I did for Barry's in-laws, for his father-in-law and mother-in-law. Mm-hmm. They had a cabin up in the forest, and it had a great spot. And anyway, they wanted me to do it, and I was happy to do it. And that's how I ended my stained glass career.
It's everybody who walks into that cabin just goes, wow, that's incredible. That is so beautiful. And very proud to say, my brother Stan made those.
So a couple of things. First of all, Barry, and I've read carefully your book, The Importance of Being Ernie, so I know so much about your family life, you too, Stan. It was one of the things I didn't know about you before, that, you know, your folks were just like regular people, the good old regular accounting and housewife. I'm kidding. Your folks really had very different backgrounds that may have led to your desires. Yeah, tell folks what your parents did for a living.
Well, you know, my dad, early days in his life, he was a theater owner. He had theaters in Baltimore. And back in the day, in the 30s, 40s, even probably early 50s, theaters of that era would show films, but they'd also have comedians. They'd have jugglers between. They were almost a 24-hour operation. They had striptease. They had, burlesque. And that's where he met my mom. My mom was one of the burlesque dancers there in the Gypsy Rose Lee fashion. And so, yes, my parents were a little unorthodox. They were wonderful people and a lot of fun to be around. So, yes, it wasn't Ward and June Cleaver that we had as parents. It was quite different.
I love it. And you're not the only kid, Stan, but you were the kids that – and I know you, Barry writes about the story that you went to kind of sign up for the union one day, and all you did was you had to just sign a piece of paper, and Barry, you signed along with them. Stan, was it always your goal, even as a little kid, that the performing, the television, that was going to be your world?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think early on I knew I wanted to perform. I mean, before I was doing it professionally when I was in school, you know, even as young as kindergarten and first grade, I was, you know, I went to public school, and they put on shows, and you know, I seem to gravitate towards those. I remember being in them. I remember being the MC of some of them. And I remember wearing a costume. I think I wanted to be the policeman, but I ended up being the milkman. So I had this white outfit on, carrying around some bottles of milk. But yeah, then my love of TV, you know, TV was just coming in, and I was like, wow, how do you get to be in there inside that box and do what I like to do in there? And it was just the confluence of events. We went to a swim school in Hollywood where we kind of whiled away the days when we were young, and the lady that owned it was very entrepreneurial. She had magazines come down and cover us little kids, and we'd be diving off high dives. She put swings and cars underwater, and they had a porthole inside of the pool, and photographers would come down and photograph us. So she got a lot of publicity for the pool, which drew a lot of Hollywood-type people there. And there was an agent who was brought her daughter there to learn how to swim, and she saw me, and, you know, I was blonde, cute, extroverted, and so she talked my mom into sending me out, and yeah, I went out on some things early on. I didn't have any lines, you know, pretty much an extra, but I did an Ozzy and Harriet at one point, and I was hired as an extra, just a neighborhood kid, and Ozzy gave me a line to say. Because of that, I was able to join the Screen Actors Guild and as a professional actor. And wouldn't you know it, he kept calling me back. So, you know, I probably did about two or three shows a year for the Nelsons and started doing movies and other TV shows, which led up to my three sons, and I got cast in that.
And Barry, one of the things I love that's very clear, Stan, of course, wrote the foreword for your book. It's very clear from both of your words. There's no rivalry between you. There's no, you just really love each other and wish each other success. So allow it to me to bring up the bad story, which is you guys worked in a film together, Barry, with unbelievably Paul Newman. I got to be honest, Barry, you got fired.
Yeah, that was my welcome to Hollywood. that was my very first film, and Stan, I think, we had already been working a little bit, got cast as, you know, went to the audition, I believe is how it occurred. He went to the audition. I was in the outer office with my mom waiting. Producers in those days, if they like you, they sometimes just come out, hey, we love your kid, we're going to hire him. And then they needed another boy who was the second son in Rally Around the Flag Boys, which is the Paul Newman film we're talking about. And they go, oh, they go, well, that's Stan's brother. And you go, well, is he an actor? And, you know, I was 4 or 5 years old. And I was like, my mom just goes, yeah, he's an actor, too. And lo and behold, they go, well, we could use him. So anyway, but I got fired because my eyes started crossing in the middle of the shoot during one of the scenes, you know, supposed to ignore Paul Newman, who was coming through the door and just watch the TV. And my eyes, you know, I was supposed to just be looking, Stan and I were on a sofa, supposed to be looking at the TV, ignore Paul. And every time they do it, the director would flip out. He'd go, God, God, Barry and I looking at the TV. And, you know, we did it 4 or 5 times. Eventually, they realized something's happening. They thought maybe I was having a seizure. Anyway, they took me to hospital, said I need glasses. Came back to the set, whatever it was, a day or two later. And the producers thought, well, he didn't have glasses when we hired him. This is not the look that we're going for here. And so I was fired from my first job, although I'm still in the movie. I'm upside down in the very first scene that you see that character, the kid, Joanne Woodward and Chrissy Kilbride have me by my feet, and they're trying to shake a coin out of me that I swallowed. But in the rest of the movie where the kid's standing up on his feet, it's a totally different kid, totally different actor, you know, the kid that replaced me.
And of course, you guys were, you know, little guys at the time. And, you know, when I read through the story, and I know the story anyway, of the people you guys worked with. I mean, you know, you're walking around the set. There goes Lucille Ball, who I know loved you, Barry. And we'll talk about your role as Arnold Mooney. But Stan, let me ask you, as a kid, did you have an appreciation for the caliber of stars that are just roaming around the studio along with you guys? Because it's a who's who that you worked with, hardly a name in the business you guys didn't pass one way or the other. Did it matter to you, or were you young and so it didn't really connect, Stan?
Not at all. I mean, you know, even working with Fred McMurray, you know, we were oblivious to their stature in the industry. You know, so you're much older and go, oh my God, this guy's really, you know, was a huge actor. But yeah, when I got hired, he was just the guy playing the dad. You know, I had seen him in The Shaggy Dog, and I'd seen him in The Absent-Minded Professor. But yeah, you know, we were fortunate, the films that we got cast in, you know, early on, including my three sons with Fred McMurray, who was probably at the peak of his career by then. But back, the guy that Barry mentioned that fired him, the director, was Leo McCarey. And Leo McCarey, you know, one of the biggest directors in Hollywood. He's the guy that put Stan Laurel with Oliver Hardy. That's how far back he went. So, you know, he'd already was a huge director.
He directed directed Duck Soup too with the Marx Brothers. He was a real old screamer.
And Bill, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying, yeah, I mean, the different movies we did, you worked with Jerry Lewis, The Errand Boy, Jackie Gleason, Papa's Delicate Conditions. I was doing a film with Doris Day and David Niven later, Please Underneath the Daisies, and Charlie Bronson, one of his early films called X-15. Yeah, early part of our career before My Three Sons came along, worked with a lot of huge people.
Oddly enough, we were actually working with the same star at the same time in pictures that were being totally different pictures that were being filmed simultaneously, and that was Debbie Reynolds, because I did a film called My Six Loves, and Debbie was working with us on the weekdays at Paramount, and then she would fly out to Lone Pine or Flagstaff, Arizona, and work with my brother Stan on the weekends in a huge, huge Western called How the West Was Won. So, oddly enough, we were working with the same star at the same time, but in different pictures.
Wow. And I have to ask you, I could spend a million hours just talking about the different folks you worked with, because I'm just such a huge fan of all of them. And Jerry Lewis, I got from his son, Chris, a pair of the Nutty Professor teeth and glasses that Jerry used to keep in his desk. They're not the actual ones from the movie. The ones he put on all the time when somebody came over. And a pool cue signed by Paul Newman and Jackie Gleason. So I just got to ask you, just real quickly, Barry, I'll come to you. Jackie Gleason, I mean, when I'm asked for one of the great actors of all time, everybody thinks Dustin Hoffman, whatever they are. But Gleason, to me, who could make you cry in Gigot and laugh your rear off in The Honeymooners, what was he like to work with? Was he good with kids? Tell me about Jerry and Jackie.
I worked with Jerry and Jack, and you know, Jerry was manic. I did Errand Boy with him, and he was running around the set like a nut, as I recall. I was a little kid myself, and probably. But he seemed like he had even more frenetic energy than me. I think years later, he kind of confessed he had an amphetamine addiction. But nonetheless, you know, he was the star of the day. He was writing, directing, starring in all of his comedies. And so it was really exciting for me to get to work with somebody who was, you know, a really like the Jim Carrey of his era. And then Jackie Gleason, absolutely loved from The Honeymooners. I had a pretty small part in that film, but nonetheless, it was awesome to be in the presence of the great one. And, he was pretty sloshed pretty much most of the time. I recall him crashing his golf cart into some telephone pole on the lot or something. And, you know, I think he'd had a little too much in his lunch hour that day. But, both of those guys were great, great actors, great comedians.
Well, it's something you were used to working with Bill Frawley and some of the other ones. So that the drinking was something you guys realized, you know, went on. And Stan, again, when I just have people like, you know, Lucille Ball in my mind, Vivian Vance. And again, but, you know, see, I get little tips because Barry writes about all these people. But what was your impression of them? Because Barry writes very positively of Lucy, as everybody would. But Vivian, Barry, you're sort of like, maybe she wasn't as nice as people thought. I don't mean to misquote you. If I am, you can correct that. But just sort of interested in well, let me ask you, am I misquoting that when you sort of wrote about that?
You're saying the Vivian, I mean,
You talked about Vivian Vance as being a little more distant, not exactly as warm as Lucy
was.
Yeah,
well, I didn't have that much to do with her, frankly. And yeah, I think she was a little bit more aloof and I don't know, you know, Lucy was running the studio while she was shooting her show when I worked with her. So she could be brutal on her writers. I mean, she was, you know, when in front of the camera, she turned on the charm and, you know, could be as funny as you know, she wanted to be. But behind the scenes, she was a real taskmaster and very sweet with me, you know, really, really very, very kind.
And well, I know she loved it.
That's not uncommon that people have dual personalities, one for the screen and the public and another one when they're behind the scenes working with the, you know, people that are trying to get a job done.
Stan, do you remember getting in trouble with
business? You wear a lot of hats.
Yeah. Do you remember getting in trouble, Stan, with your brother when you were hitting a ball against the wall and Gary Morton, Lucy's husband, saw that you were marking up the wall? Barry, I'm sure you remember the story. Do you, Stan?
Oh, we did more than mark up the wall. we hit a baseball right through his office window. And I think
that was my day. And Lucy, you know, he couldn't believe it that I, you know, little pockmarks, you know, on this gigantic stage wall left all these, you know, black stains or whatever. But anyway, he thought it was going to cost him a fortune. He rolled up in his golf cart and started yelling at me. And then Lucy arrived in her golf cart and started yelling at Gary and said, "Leave the kid alone. Come on, Gary, we got to go somewhere. We got a meeting." And then turned to me and said, "Keep playing, kid. Keep playing, honey. You know, one day you'll be on the Dodgers. Don't mind him." And so, yeah, that was fun.
Barry, this is your chance to come clean with everything. Can we talk about you and your brother being accomplices to a murder? I'm talking about the cat.
About what was you talking about?
I'm talking about the cat.
Oh, the cat. Well, Stan, you can field this one about the cat.
Well, it was a negligent homicide or something. Yeah. Well, in between scenes, the only thing left for a kid to do, especially after we had Gary Morton there, and he pretty much nixed everything we wanted to do in between scenes to get some exercise. And Nick's riding a bike, Nick's riding a skateboard, Nick's playing baseball, basketball. We were pretty much down to knitting socks or whatever. And during the period where we would ride bikes around the studio, well, on studio lots, they purposefully have cats there to catch rats. And anyway, Barry and I, you know, we play chase or tag or whatever. We came around a corner one day, and we ran over a cat and killed it. Yeah, I guess I ran over its neck, or Barry did. I don't remember exactly. But just laying there, we thought, wow, we're going to be in trouble. And we decided to dispose of the carcass, and we went under the stage and put it under the stage where we work, which was stage 11. And we didn't think to bury it. We just figured we'll leave it there. Nobody will ever see it. And anyway, that was fine for about 3 months until the cat rotted away and turned into a bunch of maggots, which turned into flies. And then we were shooting, and then all of a sudden, on the sound stage, these flies started appearing, and they're everywhere, like, you know, crawling on Bill Frawley's lip and on Fred McMurray's toupee and stuff. And we'd have to keep cutting, and somebody would have to hit the fly and reshoot the scene. But, I mean, it finally got to the point where there were literally just hundreds of flies, and they had to shut the production down. And somebody went under the stage, the guy fumigated and found a cat carcass that had become decomposed. And Gary and I, well, we realized we never realized a cat would decompose like that and turn into a bunch of flies. So we just kind of swore a pact that we would never ever talk about it or confess or say it was us to put the cat under there.
I promise I won't tell anybody about it.
Yeah. Well, the only guy that mattered was the production manager, producer, because it probably cost them $40,000 to lose the day or a couple of days of shooting. And anyway, years later, Barry and I were having lunch with John Stevens, who was the producer of my piece. And we finally said, "Hey, John, remember that time we shut down, you know, my cat?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah." And we had like a good laugh over there. Well, that was Barry and I put the cat on the stage. So we finally did come clean, at least with the producers.
I love it. And Barry, you also share that Don Grady, who played the older brother Robbie, that the original one that was going to be for the role didn't work out was Ryan O'Neill. I never knew that, and so I'll ask you to address that. But at the same time, did you know that actually Don Grady didn't want the role of Robbie, but he had his eyes set on another series that he didn't get, and that's how he got Robbie?
No, I didn't know that. I mean, what other series was he thinking about?
It was called like Larimore or something like that. I'm going to mess up that name, but Larimore, something like that. And it only lasted one season. So some stuff I read from Don, he made the point that that's the show he wanted. That went to somebody else, but it opened up the door for him to get Sons.
Oh, well, no, I'd never heard that. But, I know Ryan O'Neill was shot. They did some shooting with him in the pilot. And I believe it was Fred McMurray who didn't take kindly to him and didn't think he was very funny, which is not true because Ryan O'Neill had a fabulous career as an adult, particularly in comedies. But, you know, it all worked out for the best. Don
I think my mother knew Mary Grady, who was Don's mom, and she was privy to the inside workings of what was happening in the pilot. She said, hey, I just got to get, and Mary was an agent, a children's agent, as well as Don's mom. And anyway, she said, there's a part that's coming up. They just let Ryan go, and the middle son, Robbie, they're going to have to recast. So she very quickly got Don in there, and Don impressed them and got the role. So that's the story I know.
Yeah. And that's why I was glad to add a little bit to it. And Stan, you know, because Fred McMurray was guaranteed he would only work, I think it was 16 weeks a year, and I think he got 10 weeks off midway between that. There's a gig we should all get. But that means that the continuity people, you all had to work together. A very quick side story, Kathy Garber, a good friend of all of ours, she knows I collect a variety of things. Stan, I have your slippers as Chip, and we share those with the Museum of Broadcast Communications here in Chicago. But Kathy gave me a pendant that she wore as Sissy in Family Affair, and they had the same deal with Brian Keith as you guys had with Fred McMurray. But anyway, so after Brian Keith did his scenes, Kathy says she borrowed the pendant, went out one night and, you know, to a party or something, and then weeks later they said, Kathy, got to wear that pendant, continuity, and she couldn't find it. So they ran around the city, tried to find something that looked like it, and you can see the difference when you watch the show. But the long story short is that Kathy gave me the pendant, that the one they ultimately used, and then years later she found the original one and gave that to me too, so I have both of them. But it just raises the issue of the continuity issues that you guys had. Stan, can you talk about, did you have issues like that with working around Fred's schedule?
Yeah, we had it even not working around Fred's schedule. I mean, you know, the tough part is because of that particular type of, you know, shooting schedule that we had, where we were working multiple episodes a day. Yeah, I mean, part of the problem, I couldn't even correct, I think one year when I was like 14, I grew about 5 inches over the summer. So, none of my clothes fit 4 months later, 5 months later. So I don't know how they fixed that. I guess they didn't shoot any long shots of me, but yeah, there's all kinds of things. And you know what? The lady that did this, her name is Jeannie Belcher. She was our continuity person, and she rarely, rarely screwed up. I mean, you could... She could tell you, oh, right here you scratched your head in the master. So, you know, if you wanted to match it, you could do it. Or thank God we didn't. Nobody smokes on the show, because that's always problematic when you're shooting films. Is, you know, how long is that cigarette? You know, you can have a full cigarette in the master, and by the time they get to your close-up, which is, you know, 1 second later in the film, you're down to a stub or something. But... a couple of times we screwed up. There was I've watched episodes where there's a door open in the background, and later in the close-up it's closed. Or some of our clothes were pretty close. We used to wear polished cotton pants a lot because they didn't always want us in jeans. And the color he was either tannish green and a yellowish, you know, tan. And sometimes those would get screwed. I only remember once I had to shoot something over because I absolutely had the wrong pants on, and I remember the wardrobe guy getting chewed out, so I don't know how he screwed up. And she didn't catch it. It wasn't until I cut it together. Go, wait a minute. This guy's pants don't match. So, most of the time, it was pretty straightforward.
Stan, one quick follow-up. You said nobody smoked on the set, but Fred, of course, used to always be seen with a pipe and stuff. Was he smoking the pipe?
He was actually smoking the pipe, you know, even in the scene. You know what he would do, though? If you look at it carefully... He's not really smoking it that much. He plays with it. That was kind of his prop, you know. And in fact, I remember I either asked him about it, I said, why do you always do that? He says, because I never know what to do with my hands. So it's something to have in my hands and fiddle with. And, you know, giving an actor a prop sometimes actually is, you know, somebody's nervous or, you know, not really doing something. If you have them do something, like wash the dishes while you're doing your lines or vacuuming or going through some paperwork, you know, they become much more natural than if they're just standing there with their arms at their side doing their lines. So yeah. That's kind of a trick anyway.
And Barry, I know you guys have talked so much about the William Frawley versus William Demmer situation. So there's just so much out there about that yes, Frawley really drank and, you know, all that. Although a couple of things I wanted to clarify with you, it did seem that you guys sort of got along better with Frawley, funny enough, than you did with Demarest, just in terms of personality and his being real. Is that part true, that Frawley was an easier character to work with?
Well, Frawley was
you know, for all his cantankerous exterior, was pretty soft-hearted guy, very sentimental, very, very generous, and loved to swear, which we thought was you know, the funniest thing in the world, because he could really string them together. And, you know, but drinking was one of his downfalls eventually. And Demarest was similar. He was cantankerous. He just didn't seem to have that sweet, soft center that Frawley had. Not that he was a mean guy. He just was a different human being completely. But, you know, he was like Frawley after rehab. You know, he just was a little bit on edge and not quite as well lubricated as Bill Frawley was. But he was a nice man, you know. I mean, in his own way, he was a lot of fun. And, you know, I remember him. One of my regrets is he always wanted to talk about Preston Sturges and the great films that he did, Lady Eve and The Great McGinty and some of these other classic films. And, I was just naive about that in those days. And there were no art houses that you could go to even see these old movies. Occasionally they'd pop up on the million-dollar movie. And, you know, but I just never got there. And so, you know, I always blew him off, you know, sadly. I just went, I'm reading the box scores from the Dodger game. Yeah. Oh, The Great McGinty, huh? Okay, yeah, that sounds fun. Miracle of Morgan's Creek, what is that? Okay. So, but now, you know, years later, going, well, how dumb was I? That would have been lovely to get some inside stories on, you know, those great films and Bill's involvement in them.
And Barry, you did write about the fact that Frawley had to leave the show. He was getting ill. He couldn't get insured anymore. So producers said, that's it. You got to go. And there is a scene. There is a moment, I guess, when, or at least on the set, where Demarest and Frawley pass each other. And you could kind of cut the tension with the knife a little bit between those two, because Frawley didn't want to leave the series.
No, he didn't, and I think it was, you know, he had really loved the identity of becoming Bub, you know, and he was well known, you know, before that, but I think Bub was, you know, very dear to his heart, and he was dear to America's heart. And I think Frawley and Demarest were always competitors prior to My Three Sons. You know, they were the guys, you know, the third banana, you know, in a Cagney film or something. And so, you know, they for whatever reason, they just didn't seem like they jived, you know, and it was, I think, hard for Frawley to give up his role to a competitor and maybe somebody he wasn't terribly friendly with. I never really knew, but maybe it was just, you know, Frawley was just not happy about being let out, you know, released from his contract. But, yeah, you know, he passed away soon after, not long after he was released.
Right. That's the problem, too, when you're working on a show for that long. You really do become like family. And because Bill never was married and had kids or grandkids, you know, Barry and I kind of became the surrogate grandkids he never had. So there was more going on than just really what was on the screen. I mean, I think he really did have some affection for us and liked being with us. And, you know, I think part of his cantankerousness was, you know, part of his shtick, you know, that he knew it tickled us pink when he would go bananas and use all these really colorful curse words and stuff. So, he was a heck of a guy. And by the time, you know, Bill Demarest rolled around, I was probably 15, 16. So, you know, it wasn't quite as funny or original. And I wasn't really searching for my long-lost grandfather by then. So, different person, different time.
And there was a great, of course, we all know that Bill Frawley and Vivian Vance didn't like each other. They, you know, that's another story a long time. And Frawley, of course, the stories that I used to read was how when Tim Considine went to the reserves and some generals would come to the set to inspect and they all wanted to meet him. And you guys were walking down with Frawley. I know, Stan, you were there. And they said, what's it like? What's Vivian Vance like in all of that? And I think, Stan, as you once told me the story, when you just kind of covered your face and said, oh, no, because he doesn't hide this from anybody.
No, he wore his feelings right on his sleeve.
Stan, yeah. that was your story, right?
He would just begin.
Go ahead, Stan.
Oh, what am I talking about? So Frawley and Vivian?
Well, just the fact that when generals and army people would come to inspect the set, which was part of the deal, I guess, with Tim going off to the reserves, they would always want to talk to Frawley about working with Vivian Vance, and there was no holding him back on his attacks.
Yeah, no, he'd give me his opinion of it, which was usually like a machine gun of four-letter words, you know. But like I said, later I came to believe that, you know, they had whatever they had at some moment in time, And they, I think that they saw that that amused people, the fact that they would get into it verbally, and were only happy to oblige, you know, anytime, any place.
Yeah, I think what I'd heard, too, I mean, the origin of whatever perceived, you know, bad blood that, that arose is when they were casting I Love Lucy, and she had Bill Frawley in the office, and I think Vivian was in the other, an adjacent room, but, you know, within earshot. Bill didn't know she was there, and Lucy told Bill Frawley, hey, I just want to tell you, no, it was the opposite. She was telling Vivian, and Bill was in the other room, she told Vivian that Bill Frawley's going to play your husband in this new show I'm doing, I Love Lucy. And she blurted out, what, that old fart? Nobody would believe I could be married to that guy. And I think he heard it from the other room, and that, you know, that started the ball rolling.
I love it. And by the way, Barry, was it a little weird? We're almost going to wrap up here in a moment, but, you know, here you and Stan are really brothers, and yet in the show, you're the foster child. You're the adopted brother, and you're the only real blood. Was that ever weird, or did viewers ever catch on to that?
It was all fiction. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it was just whatever the writers cooked up, you just went with it. So, it was great for me because I came onto the show initially as the friend next door. But so, you know, when Tim decided to leave the show, conveniently, I was in the bullpen and, Tim left. And then I was, nobody told me that. I don't even know if that was planned ahead of time. Maybe Tim was already making rumblings that he wanted to leave the show. And they went, well, we better have some backup plan. And what if we had a kid that we could adopt? But that idea was never floated to me, like you're coming onto the show as potentially maybe being a son in a year or so. So, you know, but it's just the way it worked out and, you know, happy that it did.
Yeah. And just sort of finally, and Stan, I'll ask maybe both of you, you know, the show, obviously the tenor changes as we have the dad, the nanny, and the three sons. And of course, all the women start to enter the picture as the years go on, as you're each getting married in the show, and Katie and Polly and all of that. There comes Dodie. Was your sense that adding the woman, was that an important dynamic for the show to have, or did it change the dynamic in a way that shifted what the show was all about, Stan?
No, it did shift the show. I mean, the whole conceit of the show is a bunch of guys living together, you know, a grandfather, a dad, three sons, a male dog. And, that worked for a while, but, it wasn't going to work forever. That people got older, they want to meet women. Tim met Sally, Meredith McRae, and, moved out of the show. And that's how Barry came onto the show. Well, he was actually already there as a friend, but he became a son. Don Grady met Tina Cole, played Katie, and had kids. So it was kind of the natural progression, but it did pull away from, the idea of this all-male household, which is how it started. And that was fairly novel, I guess, in 1960. In the early 1960s, there weren't a lot of divorces. When people, their wives would pass away, and you would have a bachelor dad raising kids. But that was fairly novel for a TV show in those days.
And Barry, you actually open your book with sort of the discussion of there's sort of two kinds of child celebrities these days. And you talk about being at an autograph show, and I know you guys make appearances. Hopefully you'll come to Chicago when they resume those. And you sort of talk about the folks that there are those who are in these shows and then went on to become insurance agents, whatever they went on to do, no longer child actors. And then there were those who continue. I think you, in one of the stories, it was at Dustin Hoffman, it was somebody, no, it was Richard Dreyfuss, who was at a party. So you were talking about being at a show, and, on one side of you is a Dreyfuss kind of, who's going to do the show and then go off to do movies the next week, and others who have moved on to other things. You guys have always stayed with the business one way or another. What is your sense of why there's this strong sense of nostalgia for people? Because, I grew up with all that, but it is 2021. I still love the shows of the 60s and mainly the 60s.
Nostalgia is very comforting to people, and it takes you out of the real world. And some of the programming that you see today is pretty confrontational, and sometimes it's good to just escape. And that's kind of what a nostalgia is. It takes you back to a time in your youth that when things were seemingly simpler and happier. And there's something for everybody, and that's just the nature of entertainment. And some shows survive, like some actors survive, some don't. And it's out of my hands. You just do it,
give it your best shot, and however it lands, that's the way it is.
And Stan, are you good sort of in these, you know, as the years go on, we're so many years past the show, but embracing the character that you were? I mean, even in this interview, we're talking about it. We're talking about those days. Is your reaction to this sort of like, oh, here we go again? Or is it, no, I'm good with this?
No, I'm good with it at this point. Yeah, there was a period of time probably when I was fresh off of, you know, my three sons, you know, that it was like, oh, I got to bury this quick. I got to go on or I'm going to be typecast forever as Chip. And guess what? I was for a pretty long time. And, you know, those were the jobs. That, you know, if I knew what I knew now, I would have embraced those jobs even more, going, well, hey, you're lucky. You could be doing something different. You know, instead I was getting work as an actor and continued to do that. But, you know, I started a production company when I was 20, 21, with a partner. And, you know, that kept me pretty busy. And you know, I could see the writing on the wall. I go, you know, I've already done this for like, what, 15, 20 years. Maybe time to do something else, but it would be related to show business and what I did before. And I could take what I knew and dump it into that. And, you know, that's kind of the direction I went in.
Well, I'm glad you guys stayed in. It's an honor for folks like me who grew up with all of that, loved all of it. Would never occur to me when I was, and we're all about the same age, but when I was, you know, a kid watching you stuff that one day, hey, I get to talk to you and meet you and know you. And it really is. It's just, and I'm so glad you you embrace that, the background, and continue to talk about it. And as I said, and people can still get your book, I'm sure, Barry, The Importance of Being Ernie is just such a great revisit to all of. We didn't even get to your Dick Van Dyke getting yelled at by Carl Reiner. So many stories in your background that usually involve you getting yelled at.
My limo ride with Elvis. That's what everyone wants to hear about. But yeah, it's in the book. Get the book. You can read all about it.
Exactly. And see Notorious Nick. And Stan, will keep an eye out for your next projects as well. Guys, thank you so much for spending all this time with me. I wasn't sure how much we could get done, but you stayed with me and we got to go for quite a while, and that's really been great. I thank you both very much for all the years of enjoyment, but for spending time with me now.
Appreciate you having us on. Thank you, Paul, so much.
Now, ordinarily, you would hear my closing credits come up right now. We did something a little different today. I'm going to share it with you. So Barry had some car trouble before we started the interview, and he was late for the interview. But Stan was ready to go early, and because we're kind of on a schedule in recording our podcasts, we decided the best thing to do would be to interview Stan, because we weren't sure we'd ever get Barry because of the issues he was having. And so we recorded a podcast with Stan. It's a standalone conversation. But rather than sort of not sharing it with you, we thought if you are a fan of My Three Sons, of the Livingston Brothers, of those days, you might just enjoy listening to this, because Stan and I talked about some different things than we did in our discussion with Barry as well. So we're going to go ahead and share with you the extra podcast that wasn't intended to be recorded, but did get recorded. We'll share it with you now and hope you enjoy it. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. This is Paul Lisnick from WGN-TV and doing a little retro TV with you today. You knew that theme song, of course, one of the classic iconic theme songs of all time from My Three Sons. And joining me now is the actor who played Chip, the, well, I suppose, youngest and middle and son of that show. Stan Livingston joins us from California. Stan, thanks for joining me. I haven't talked to you in a little bit. Good to talk to you.
Yeah. Hey, Paul. How have you been? Good to talk to you.
I am doing great, and I always love talking about the good old days. And for folks who are, you know, because, you know, listen, My Three Sons is playing somewhere everywhere, including in the Chicago area and everywhere else. We can always catch it. And then people sort of from those days of childhood, you've gone on, you've done some acting, but you've become a director. Fill folks in on what Stan Livingston's life is like now, and an artist, I might add.
Yes, an artist. Well, that came about as spending so many hours on a sound stage when I was a kid, there really wasn't anything to do where you couldn't make noise. So I picked up, you know, pencils, pen and ink, paintbrushes, and learned how to paint. And yeah, I did that for a while. In fact, I have a website up where my art is. If you go to stanleylivingstonart.com, you can see some of the things I did in the past. People always ask me about it, so I wanted to show them and leave a place where people could find it. But yeah, these days, you know, really since My Three Sons was over, I've had a production company, First Team Productions, and you know, we've done everything from music videos to industrials to commercials to feature films. We even did a Cinerama film back in 2012. So that's pretty much what keeps me busy, although the last year or so with the COVID has really been kind of a bear. You know, it's just they don't want you shooting and they don't want you getting together with, you know, 30 people in a room and try and shoot a production, you know, with the actors and the crew and everything. Everybody, well, at least the cast has to unmask. So the Screen Actors Guild has a mandate. It's pretty tough to get around, and it's expensive to shoot right now because of all the protocols. But, you know, we're trying to get through it. Right now I've got a sitcom that I'm trying to get funded. We've got a couple people interested in it, and I don't want to put the whammy on it. But, yeah, hopefully that comes up. It'll be something that my company's producing. I'll be directing, and it's a pretty funny show if we can get it up.
Well, since I'm in SAG-AFTRA as well, I can star in the show if you need.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Now, the one thing you didn't mention about art, by the way, is, of course, you used to do stained glass. I have several of your stained glass art pieces, and you probably remember you did a very special one for me, which was the My Three Sons logo, and you had all the brothers, you know, Don Grady was still around. You had them all over for a barbecue, and everybody signed it, and it hangs proudly on my wall.
Yes, I do remember that. Well, I did stained glass. That was kind of, I decided to take a break from production and acting back in 19, gosh, I think this was 82. And I really didn't intend to, you know, do a lot of artwork. I happened to live in a house that's on a main street in Hollywood called Laurel Canyon. And I did this particular stained glass that I was working on just for myself and for fun. And when I was done with it, I hung it up. I used to work in my garage, so I hung it up on the garage door, which faced the street. And then, you know, I started to work on a second piece. Anyway, the second day I did that, some guy pulled into my yard and said, "Hey, do you do stained glass?" And I was kind of, yeah, I guess I do. So he said, "Well, could I buy that?" And I said, "Well, that one's really," I didn't know what to tell him. So he says, "Well, would you take $200 for it?" And I went, okay. The materials cost me about $10 and a little bit of my time, and I sold it, and I just thought, well, that was weird. And then I just kept working on the next one. Well, the very next day, somebody else pulled in my yard, and they had this little drawing, a sketch, and they said, "I saw that you do stained glass. Where's that unicorn?" And I said, "Oh, somebody bought that." And they said, "Well, could you do this?" I went, sure. So yeah, well, they gave it to me, and they hired me, and I did it. Flash forward a couple of years, and, you know, anytime I wasn't doing anything, I used to go away in those days and go do plays. I was still doing TV as an actor. I'd come back and throw my garage door open and start working on some more things. I got a little more sophisticated. Finally, I built a stand, drug it out by the street, and, yeah, you know, over a period of about 8 years, I think I did about 1,000 commissions. So,
well,
that could have been another whole life for me. But, yeah, it was fun. And, in fact, on that website I mentioned, that StanleyLivingstonArt.com, there's a page there, or a link to some of my stained glass. So if you want to catch what I was doing way back then, it's there.
I love it. And, of course, I love the pieces I have. Let's talk about My Three Sons a little bit, because it is such days, and I think a lot of people know this, but what was really unusual with these Don Federson productions, you and Family Affair, we, of course, have our mutual friend Kathy Garver, but Don Federson, I think, had this great idea where you can get big stars like Fred McMurray in your case, Brian Keith in Kathy's case, and basically have them do everything they had to do over, like, what, about 16 weeks? And I know McMurray had a special provision giving him 10 weeks off in between the two halves, and then the rest of the cast would just have to film around him, and that's how you got a guy like McMurray in there.
Yeah, well, that actually became known as the McMurray method of shooting, that is. And, I mean, yeah, they were all over themselves that they had a star of that caliber doing a TV show that really wasn't that common back in those days. Most of the people that they would get to do TV shows were, you know, actors who had a career and they were kind of on the downslope of their career. But Fred really was at the apex of his career at that moment. He had just years leading up to My Three Sons, 3 years before, just the McCain Mutiny, The Apartment, The Shaggy Dog, The Absent-Minded Professor. So at that time, he was the highest paid actor in Hollywood. But what happened is his wife, June, and he had adopted some twins, Katie and Laurie, and Fred decided he didn't want to go off and do, you know, motion picture production, which usually requires you're on location somewhere for anywhere from 3 to 6 months, and you come home, and by the time you come home, your kids are in college. So he was looking around for something that he could do in L.A. Don Federson, our executive producer, approached him with the idea of doing the show, and then he said, hey, this might work for me. I just want to work from 8 in the morning, 6 o'clock at night, and go home, be with my kids. I want to have the summer off to go away. And they accommodated him by creating that production schedule. But it kind of initially wreaked a little bit of havoc, you know, for the actors. If you're used to shooting, you try and shoot pretty much in the order of the script as much as you can. But this necessitated us shooting in sometimes 5-6 different scripts a day just to knock scenes out that Fred was in. And if he walked out of a scene before it was over, we wouldn't even shoot that. They would just stop. Cameraman would step in with a Polaroid, take a picture of where we were at, and we'd come back, you know, 3 months, 6 months later and pick up that scene and finish off the scene. And it was the same thing if he was to walk into a scene. We'd shoot the initial part of it, and then 6 months later, Fred would be back from vacation, all nice and tan, and we'd pick up the scene where he opened the door and walked in.
Probably had some continuity issues on that one. Now, I have to ask you. I have to ask you one fun thing. You know, your brother wrote The Importance of Being Ernie years ago. I have it. I've read it, and you wrote the foreword to it. And he tells a story in there which surprised me a little bit, although it didn't, I guess Hollywood knew, but that Fred McMurray was really pretty frugal. He sort of talked about some stories where you'd go out to eat, and Fred would want to split the check with everybody, including the kids. And at one point, you were having to pay a parking fee of $1. He wanted everybody to split it. Was he really kind of a cheap guy, even though he was a lovely father figure?
I've heard the same stories, and Fred was parsimonious, I guess you would say, in that, you know, this guy could have afforded any car he wanted, which is a status symbol, you know, if you're an actor in Hollywood, a Lamborghini, a Ferrari, or if you're older, a Bentley or Mercedes or a Rolls Royce. Fred drove a Pontiac station wagon, and it was given to him to use, not even to buy. Because Pontiac was our sponsor. And, yeah, I've heard all those stories about, you know, Fred going to the ball game. When they got to the parking lot, it was $1.25, and everybody had to ante up a quarter in the car. You know, probably part of that was, I think, it was just his upbringing. He wasn't an ostentatious guy. And I think what he was doing was kind of trying to bring himself down to the level of the other people in the car. Meaning, you know, he's just an average guy. That, you know, when you're a teenager or a young adult, that's what you would do with your buddies. You know, it's like, hey, we're going out cruising tonight, meet girls, and five guys would pile into your car. First thing you do is go to the gas station, and you go, give me $1. Everybody give me $1 for the gasoline. That would have been a lot of gasoline back there at 19 cents a gallon. But, yeah, Fred, I think just wanted to be accepted as one of the guys. I really never looked at it as a negative thing. In fact, I kind of always looked at it as, you know, almost a positive thing to do. You know, because otherwise, well, he's like, you know, high on his horse, or, you know, he buys everything because he can and treats us, you know, but, you know, he didn't want to make anybody feel bad. And that's really the way I've always looked at that.
And of course, with the two famous nannies throughout the show, William Frawley, who was Fred Mertz, and then William Demarest came in. Your brother writes a lot about them as well, so I feel like I know them. But one of the great stories, and you actually told me this story once. We don't want to use the bad language I know that happened at the time. But I know that, I think it was it Tim Considine who played Mike, was going into the Air Force Reserve or something, and there was a great story because everybody knows that William Frawley and Vivian Vance didn't get along, and I think you told me the story once of some generals, whatever, coming to visit the set, and they couldn't wait to meet William Frawley and made the mistake of asking him how it was working with Vivian Vance.
Well, he would tell anybody about how it was working with her. You know, and I've revised what I originally thought about that. You know, you have a point of view of it when you're a kid and don't know stuff or don't know the history of people. But You know, yes, they were very happy to accommodate people with an impromptu argument or a curse fest that would go back and forth. But, you know, those were almost like terms of endearment for them, I think. That's really what I got out of it later. I'm looking, going, you know what? They're just doing this to have fun when other people are looking, you know, because they think it entertains them. So I never really thought that whatever their feud was that serious. They just kind of, you know, when you get on the job and you got some guy or some girl or broad, as probably Bill probably would have called her, you know, they would just go at it. And people would laugh and, you know, fall all over themselves. So, yeah, they were doing their best, I think, to entertain people. I don't really think there was any real friction there.
Back in some years ago, there was My Three Sons Day in L.A., and I watched the whole ceremonies that played out, and I think it took place just before Don Grady passed away of cancer. And I'm just sort of curious there wasn't a lot of references to him, but I imagine that you and Don stayed friends until the end, right?
We did. Yeah, no, we were very close except for the very end, and, you know, I didn't. Yeah, whenever I would invite him to something, he couldn't go. He was supposed to go to New York with Barry, Tina, and I to do the CBS morning show, and he bowed out of that. He did do it from L.A., but he didn't want to go anywhere. And, yeah, what I didn't realize, actually, until we did that show, and Tina was kind of more of an insider on that than me, that he had cancer and had it for about 5 years. But, you know, I'd seen Don dozens of times in those 5 years, and you would have never known there was even anything wrong with them. And yeah, that My Three Sons Day in L.A., you know, I called them and said, hey, you know, we're getting this honor, you know, why don't you come to it? And he's like, let me get back to you. And then I don't remember what he or his wife Jenny called me and said he's going to be unable to make it. He's got a gig, and he has to finish the music for it. And so he didn't show up. And I was about thought that was a little strange, but I just filed it away. And by then, I hadn't seen Don in the flesh, and it was probably about 8-9 months. And anyway, like you just mentioned, it was just a couple weeks after that he passed away. I believe that was in May of 2012, and early June, Don, you know, passed away. Well, we saw him just before. They had a birthday for him on June 8th. Or June 6th, I think it was, and we went to it, and yeah, I was shocked. I, you know, as soon as I saw him, I knew I didn't want to do My Three Sons Day in L.A. You know, got an illness such as he had, cancer, and had gone through all the treatments you go through. It really kind of takes its toll on your body and physically. And if you knew Don, he was a guy that's like 68 years old that was always. I guess like he was in the best of health. I mean, he looked like he was 40 years old. And it was only that last time that I saw him that, you know, he had aged, and it was a debilitating thing, you know, to be treated for. I think he got cancer, and it was in his jaw, and it had metastasized. But boy, yeah.
Well, that explains a lot, too, because obviously he kept that very private.
It was kept quiet. Well, we did that, yeah. When we, I guess it was, a couple of years before, I think it was 2009, when we did that CBS show and Tina told us, you know, we all just right then go, hey, nobody can know about this. I know you told us, but you know, Don's like a brother to me. And he didn't even tell me. And I, you know, when I talked to him, I yelled at him. I could help, you know. I can do things that, you know, maybe you want done, or come and help your wife, or, you know. And he was really appreciative. But, you know, again, he was still working at that point, doing music for different TV shows and films. And, you know, the second You've Got Cancer comes out in Hollywood, your career is pretty much over. Why? Because if you're working on somebody's film, especially as an actor or as a musician, and they're paying you, and you don't complete the job, you know, you pass away, you know, they don't want that. So they just don't hire you. That's the polite way of handling it. So Don wanted to keep on working. So, you know, we zipped our mouths shut, and that's the way we handled it. And, you know, we didn't say anything, actually, until, you know, it became public news. I think I was downtown doing something, and somebody called me and said, it's going to be announced on the radio any second. Don just passed away a few minutes ago. So, anyway, we were prepared at that point, because when your phone starts ringing, everybody wants to interview you.
Well, that's
Yeah, that was right. rough, but
And there's so much more.
I mean, you know, I knew John from the time I was 9 years old.
Right. And there's so much to talk to you about. And, of course, I want to talk about your brother, Barry, and even have Barry join the conversation. But we're getting shortchanged on our time today, Stan, unfortunately. And so I'm going to have to leave it here with you. But I want to thank you for at least a little reminiscing, a little bit about your career, a little artwork.
Yeah.
But let's do this again. Let's get your brother, Barry, in
we'll
on
it.
And there's so much more to talk about. And I hope you'll join.
That would be fun.
All right.
That would be great. In case Barry doesn't show up, he's got a movie opening this week. Notorious Nick in the theaters. Can you believe that one?
I've actually watched it. It's a great movie, and that's I want to talk to him about that. It's very good. He's one of the stars. He kind of comes, you know, there might be a guy named Cody who some would say is a sex symbol. I think your brother Barry's the sex symbol in that movie. And
yes, he is.
But we'll talk about
guy.
That.
Stan, I love him.
And Stan Livingston, I thank you so much for your time here today. Thanks so much.
Anytime, Paul. I'm always here for you.
All right.
Love you, man.
Be well. Bye-bye. Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.